We had a schism between the people from Lincoln Laboratory and people from MIT, because they were demanding too much. They wanted a number of professorships, and we were not in a, I really can't speak for the MIT, but there was, you know, there's this kind of bickering going on. They're commanding, their salaries were very substantially larger than ours at Lincoln. In any case, what happened was that they left, the project folded. At the time, it was the largest grant that NIH had ever given. But Charlie Towns, who was the provost, said, well, we got to give them back the money. So we gave up on that. After a couple of years of the Link computer being built, most of them went to Washington University, St. Louis. The principal, as I said, was a fellow named Wesley Clark, who's still around, I think. And it was rather interesting because he and his associate, who's Bill Papian, spelled P-A-P-I-A-N, were interested in biology, and certainly Wes had been working even earlier on this computer of average transients. But as I say, they went off to Washington University, where they got appointments. Some people were at Charlie Molnar. Charlie Molnar was a graduate student in Rosenblatt's lab. He then went also to Washington University, where he was involved in particular in developing modules that could be put together to make a computer. He's dead. He died, probably a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago. Relatively young man. So that was part of my background. What else? I mentioned sectioning.
Tomography.
Bill Simon called me. Bill Simon had been in the, I know why, it's all tied together. He had been in the group at Lincoln Lab, and he decided not to go to Washington University. He had developed a little tape. They had a little memory that they used, magnetic tape memory. But in any case, so he went to University of Rochester in bioengineering. He called me up one day. Now, his mathematics is not great, but he called me up one day at MIT. He said, if you were to take a bunch of pictures of biological object, can you reconstruct a section? Okay, so I said, well, all right, let me think about it. I thought about 2 minutes, and there's a well-known theorem in mathematics called the Radon theorem or the Radon-Nikodym theorem, which tells you that, yes, indeed, you can go, if you can represent a sufficient number of two-dimensional or n-dimensional projections, you can, up to a certain level of accuracy, reconstruct a section in any other dimension, or reconstruct the n+1 dimensional object. Okay, so there's a mathematical theorem. How are you going to do it? The theorem doesn't say. So I said, really, I think I can do it. And then I started thinking about how to do it. I wasn't getting anywhere. And I talked to Ole Tridiak, and within 10 minutes or less, he said, okay, oh, this is easy. This is Fourier transform theory. Well, and he's right. It's really easy to reconstruct sections using Fourier transforms. Now, and curiously enough, the Fourier technique, even though we use it in 1968 and 69, the Fourier technique was not used in computerized tomography until much later. Somebody rediscovered it to finish off this sad story. So Tridiak worked it out. We put it in. And I leaned on him. I said, oh, boy, this is a golden opportunity. Let's do something with this. So we went over. We talked to the people at the Peter Brent Brigham Hospital Radiology Department. And I had connections with all these people because I was still, I think at the time, on the faculty Harvard Medical School as a lecturer, and I knew the head of radiology, again for strange reasons, because I knew his brother as a grammar school student. His brother, incidentally, is a, he was rather well known in the movie. His name is Mason, I think his name is Mason Adams. And he was, you know, big in Hollywood. He might still be there. But anyway, that's all side note. We went over and talked to Herb Abrams and his staff. Now, they were interested in angiography, okay? They wanted to look at little vessels, at skinny little vessels in the hand or in the brain, in the heart or something like that. Our pictures were very crude. We could only digitize in a matrix of, I think it was 32 by 32 or 16 by 16, very small number. Now, we could have done better, but it would have required more computer power than we had readily available to us. And so they looked at our pictures, and they were full of quantizing noise, and this, I said, well, you know, we have no interest. Now, it's quite clear that at the same time, the people in England, you know, were pursuing the same kind of thing, Hounsfield and so on, but what they knew that we didn't know is that the requirement is to study the brain. We didn't know. We took a picture of some bones, and we could demonstrate, and the pictures will show that we can tell the difference between the marrow of the bone and the hard material, and we can do it anywhere up and down the bone, and you can see it. So, anyway, so at that, they discouraged us. But I still didn't want to give up, and we had some connection with one of the X-ray companies. Now, which one was it? Not GE, but it was on the X-ray company. And I talked to their director of research and said, would you be interested? He said, well, yes, he said, but he really needs a better object, okay? He said, you make other pictures. I went back to Ole. I said, Ole, let's develop this. He had no interest. Well, maybe he was thinking of moving to Drexel by this time. I'm not sure. So we abandoned that. But again, I mention it as the kinds of things that sort of moved my interest in some measure, but not entirely, from what you might call pattern recognition to image processing. Okay. And there is a relation between them, even though they're ordinarily separated. In a certain sense, the image processing has to precede the pattern recognition. But even there's a problem. If you don't know what you want to process in the damn image, then what are you going to do with the image? You have to know what you're looking for, and basically that depends on your intuition about the pattern that you're looking for.